first Hamburg booking and were still without a regular drummer, Paul rang Pete and asked if he was still playing and, more importantly, had he got his own drums. Since the Kasbah had first opened, Pete had learned to play the drums and was playing in various groups. He said yes and went off with them to Hamburg. On their return, they performed at the Kasbah, this time as the Beatles, with Pete as their drummer. Hence John writing on the ceiling that he was back. It was at the Kasbah that John persuaded his art school friend Stu Sutcliffe, who had just won an important art prize, the John Moores Prize, worth £45, to spend it all on a guitar, even though he couldn't play the guitar, and come with them to Hamburg, where he fell in love with a German girl, Astrid Kircher, and then, in 1962, suddenly died of a brain tumour. All these stories and incidents are well known to Beatles fans everywhere, and now, with the Kasbah opened up again, they can visit one of the Beatles' shrines in the flesh, stand on the holy spots, imagine where the magic first emerged, relive the dramas, inspect the relics. Well, relics is perhaps a slight exaggeration. There are not a great many artifacts to see, apart from the hand-painted walls, ceilings and carvings done by John, Paul and George, and also a silhouette of John painted by Cynthia, then John's girlfriend, later his wife. But they do have on show some chairs that were there at the time, a coffee machine, some crockery, and the original Dunset record player that was used at the club. Their more valuable relics have been locked in their archives, such as a guitar played by Paul, a Vox amplifier, microphones and other sound equipment used by the Beatles while performing in the Kasbah. Most were on display when the Kasbah first reopened, but they feared wear and tear from people handling them, or worse, disappearing with them. The conducted tour lasts roughly 60 minutes. Then visitors are allowed to wander back and forth around the cellar rooms and look at things again for themselves, ending up in the coffee bar. The same one that was there in the 60s, which now doubles as souvenir shop. It contains a huge Philco fridge, which came from America, with a massive handle which can be opened on either side. Beatles fans will enjoy the excellent display of photos and documents, posters, cards and tickets from the 1959-62 period that covers the walls in every room. None is original. They are photocopies, but even so, I found them fascinating. There are many I had not seen before, such as the handwritten biographical notes each Beatle wrote while in Hamburg, a letter written to the Hamburg police by Pete after they had been expelled, and letters from Pete to his mum describing what the Beatles were doing in Hamburg. Well, some of it. Sticking to that period and gathering enough material is quite a challenge, as of course it was post-1962 that Beatlemania started and there were suddenly billions of images. They've also tried to arrange the rooms and the displays chronologically, so that you begin with the history of the Best family, descriptions of coffee bars of the period, the creation of the Kasbah, the history of the Quarrymen, before moving on to Hamburg and the Beatles. There are five main interconnecting cellar rooms in all, plus corridors and alcoves, and everything has been painted as it was in 1959, which means mainly in black. There are quite a few steps up and down between the cellars, with yellow and black warning lines and notices saying, "Mind your head." These notices used to read, "Beware the Kasbah kiss, mind your head," but every single one of them got stolen as souvenirs. Now they stick to the simpler wording. Although the cellar rooms are more numerous and spacious than I had imagined, it's still hard to believe that 300 members crammed in on that opening night to hear the Quarrymen. The record later on, for one night's attendance, when there were two sessions, was 1,331. The noise, the sweat. My dears, it must have been unbearable, for there was no air conditioning. Upstairs again, after the tour, I sat with Rogue and Pete in their office, as they described the endless meetings and form-filling that lasted a year before they got all the necessary planning, health and safety permissions. They were now in discussions once again with the planning people about putting up a sign at the front of the house. At the moment, there is nothing to tell people this is the Kasbah, though when you get into the grounds, down the drive, round at the back, there is an arrow pointing to the Kasbah Coffee Club. We are hard to find, says Rogue, which is a problem. The Beatles tours, which take people round the Beatles sites, don't include us because they say we're too far away on the wrong side of the town. People have to make their own way here. So a board at the front is vital, but to put one up we'll have to cut down some of the trees. They've just grown wild, but apparently you now can't cut down any trees in your garden without permission. My fantasy, when we do get a proper sign up, is to have a courtesy bus running here straight from Liverpool Lime Street. One thing that did happen, without them applying or even knowing, was that in 2006 the house was officially Grade 2 listed, giving it official status as a building of historic interest. It was a local historian who looked into it, investigated the whole history of the house and applied to have it listed. It means, of course, that they will have even more paperwork should they ever want to make any changes, but the house and the cellars should be preserved forever. As we were talking, I noticed people outside in the garden stumbling around. They got nearer and started staring through the window. Because of the overgrown nature of the front garden, it is possible to assume the house might not be occupied. Rogue sighed and said it happens all the time. People don't realize entry is by appointment only. When the doorbell eventually rang, he said he would have to go and send them away, tell them to book a time for tomorrow. He was too busy now, talking to me. When he came back, he said there were 10 Canadians, taxis waiting. This was their last afternoon in Liverpool, so they couldn't come back tomorrow. I said he must let them in. Don't lose customers because of me. I followed Rogue out and talked to two of them, men in their 40s. One said he was an academic with a PhD, and the other an accountant with Deloitte and Touche, both from Edmonton, Alberta. Their accents did not sound totally Canadian, and they said that was because they were originally from Yugoslavia. They knew all about the Casbah history, and that it had now opened to the public, but hadn't been aware you had to book. They were clearly thrilled to be allowed in, and to meet an actual best. Not Pete, alas, but they did know who Rogue was. I went back upstairs and talked to Pete. I wondered if in his civil service life he had ever had to sack people.
You can't, not in the civil service, he said, laughing. It's almost impossible. But I did have to discipline some people, which wasn't pleasant.
What about the Pete Best Band? Any discipline problems, rows, fallings out there?
Luckily, people have only left voluntarily, natural progression. And we don't have people going on the piss, getting drugged up and can't perform. We're all too experienced to behave like that. Or perhaps too old.
Pete has two daughters, Bieber, aged 45, and Benita, aged 41, and has been married to his wife, Kathy, since 1963.
And very happily, he added emphatically.
In one way, he has done better than any of the Beatles. Paul, not long ago, went through a nasty divorce, which means that all four Beatles got divorced at some time. Then, of course, there have been all the other tragedies and dramas.
Brian Epstein and Stu, they died young. When John got shot and George got attacked in his own home, I did each time think to myself, there but for the grace of God go I. Yes, I've been very lucky.
It had been a terrible blow to his pride and self-esteem when he was sacked, and he still doesn't know the real reason, who did the dirty deed. It took a long time to get over it, but now he can't believe he was so depressed as to contemplate taking his own life. Now, approaching 70, he can only look back with fondness to his time with them, especially the wild Hamburg years. He enjoyed the girls and the drink, as they all did, but says he took no drugs, no pills of any sort, unlike the others. Perhaps that was something that set him apart, made the others think he was perhaps a bit boring, not as amusing as Ringo. No one at the time thought his drumming was inferior.
I had two brilliant years during which we achieved so much. We became kings of Liverpool and kings of Hamburg. We did our first radio appearances, our first recording. I knew we were going to be huge because the signs were there. Unfortunately, I was the one forced to change direction, but the benefits have accrued later on. I'm very happy. I've had a good life with some great experiences few people have had. I have no regrets. He has never met any of the Beatles since he got the sack in 1962. I've made no approaches. It's up to them. The doors are always open. His mother, Mona, was contacted by John in 1967. He remembered from his Casbah days her father's military medals and wondered if he could borrow them to wear on the Sergeant Pepper cover, which he did. When the Beatles anthology was broadcast in 1995, Pete got some royalties, as it was realised he had played on one of the Love Me Do recordings. When the Casbah reopened in 2006, Rogue approached Paul McCartney for any memories, which he gave willingly and was filmed by Rogue. "It's a good idea to let people know about the Casbah," said Paul. "They know about the cavern, they know about some of those things, but the Casbah was the place it all started. We helped paint it and stuff. We looked upon it as our personal club." When Rogue returned from guiding round the Canadians, I asked if Pete himself ever led any of the tours.
"Of course he doesn't," exclaimed Rogue indignantly. "Just me and Rory or another member of the family does it. Never Pete. He's Pete Best, one of the Beatles. It would be demeaning. It would be like Paul McCartney giving guided tours round the Abbey Road studios."
I can see why Rogue enjoys doing personal tours, booked in advance. It saves on staff, and you can control times and numbers, and charge a lot more. Something to bear in mind when I open my museum. I suppose it might be amusing and distracting when I'm really old and out of work with nothing else to do. A chance to meet new people and chunter on to strangers. But dear God, I'm banking on that time never arriving. I asked about the future. When he and Pete have hung up their drumsticks, what will happen to the Casbah?
"I'm passionate about it," said Rogue. "I see it as our mum's heritage, so I want to do it for her. It's also a matter of credit where credit is due. I want the world to recognise what once happened here. However, I can't force the next generation to keep it going. I won't say to them, 'You have to do it.' If they find the house becomes a pain in the arse and they want to get rid of it, it's up to them. But I would hope that we'll try to keep it going, open to the public forever, or as long as the Beatles are remembered."
Which, of course, they will be, as long as we are on the planet and have the breath to hum the tunes. So I think, but I'm biased. All the same, I am surprised that everything connected with the Beatles, however humble and humdrum, should now be valued and revered like holy relics. Worshippers charged to look and touch if they are lucky, even when they're just scratches on a wall or roof done in an idle moment by callow youths hanging about. But that is the nature of so much of collecting, and of museums of collections, ever since ancient times. Scratches in Neolithic caves or daubs on suburban ceilings can end up being considered priceless, yet they have no real intrinsic value. It's the context, the story, the associations, the history, and of course, us. The fact that we impose importance upon them and invest them with value and power. I would hate to tell you the notional market value today of some of the unconsidered Beatles trifles that I was fortunate enough to gather. They would look good, though, if I ever get round to my own museum. Still thinking. Meanwhile, let's roll on to another museum, which, in its own way, is definitely a cut above the rest. Casbah Coffee Club, 8 Haymans Green, West Derby, Liverpool, L12 7JG. Telephone 0151 280 3519. Chapter 6. The British Lawnmower Museum, Southport. Never been to Southport. Been missing from my town collection. Collectors can collect experiences as well as things, such as visiting all 92 of England's league football grounds, or groupies notching up how many pop stars they have shagged. There's a lot to recommend collecting experiences. You don't have storage or display problems. Though there were groupies, allegedly, who took plaster casts of their conquest's private parts as souvenirs. I wonder where they kept them. Perhaps donated them to that museum in Iceland that displays penises.
They have over 250, but mainly of animals. Not been to that museum, or Iceland. I often look at maps and think, been there, not been there, must go there sometime. I've done Blackpool, which is the bigger, brasher seaside town further up the Lancashire coast, and of course, just done Liverpool again, which is to the south, but never managed to enter that bulky, bull-nosed peninsula between the two, even though it does contain such famous sporting places as Aintree and Haydock Park, and loads of golf courses such as Birkdale. I was early for the museum, which is on the outskirts of Southport, deliberately early, as I wanted to have a look at the town, added to my portfolio. I parked in a street near the museum, as there did not seem to be any parking restrictions, and decided to walk into town. I had been smiling to myself all the way here, thinking about the museum I was going to visit. Lawnmowers. I don't know why I found it so funny. "Do you want to see my lawnmowers? Got any lawnmowers to swap? In here I keep my lawnmowers." I'd been saving it up for ages, like pudding. Very foolishly, I'd arrived without a map, assuming I would pick one up when I walked into town, wherever that was. I asked a woman where the town was, and she said, "Keep walking right down Duke Street, you'll come to it." Took ages, and all the time I was thinking, "I'll see the sea soon, then I'll get my bearings." Silly name, Southport. It's neither in the south, nor is it a port, not even got a harbour. But I had heard boastings about a pier, the second longest in the UK. If it's so long, why can't I find it? I asked a man where the pier was, and he pointed along an empty, rather ugly road. I kept walking and came eventually to a sort of esplanade, and there, lurking in the background, miles and miles away across empty sands, I could definitely see sea. Then to my right I spotted what must be the pier, long and low and very plain, not nearly as handsome and ornate as the piers in Brighton. Okay, so there's only one left in Brighton, but even in its death throes it retains an architectural charm. Close up, Southport's pier was more attractive, and I was delighted to see a tram chugging along it, heading towards what looked like a glasshouse at one end, out to sea, whereas at the other end the pier just seemed to disappear into the town. I climbed up and walked along it. It is long, 3,600 feet, I discovered later, but it's a bit of a cheat as half the pier goes over land. In my book, a pier should go over water. I don't actually have a book, but I do have a collection of postcards of seaside piers, about 50 in all. I bought a job lot of 30 once and started adding to them, along with a job lot of angry seas, till I decided it was a sheer con. Whoever manufactured them back in the 1900s had just taken one photo of an angry sea and then inserted the name of whichever seaside town he was trying to sell them in. Very smart. At the end of the pier, or the beginning, for I should have started here, I found myself in Lord Street, and goodness, that was a surprise, a sheer delight to come across something so grand and impressive after the dullness of the blank sands and the tattiness of some of the seaside amusements at the end of the pier. Lord Street is about a mile long, wide and handsome, with lots of green spaces and gardens and classic public buildings on one side, while the other side consists of shops, hotels, restaurants, most of them with Victorian glass-topped canopies and arcades. At one time, it must have been clarty posh, as we say in Carlisle, and attracted the quality and wealth of industrial Lancashire. Even today, despite day-trippers strolling the broad pavements in shorts and skimpy tops, it still has a certain dignity and style. I eventually found the tourist centre in a glass conservatory on the other side, and discovered that Southport is a pure 19th-century invention. It didn't exist at all till 1792, when the first hotel was built near what is now Lord Street. It was purpose-planned as a seaside resort of the classier British kind, hence all the arcades and covered walkways. I also discovered that Prince Louis Napoleon, nephew of the great Napoleon, had lived on Lord Street in 1846. He had been imprisoned in France, then escaped, dressed as a workman. He lived in Southport the best part of 2 years, then returned to France in 1848, becoming President of the Republic and then, a few years later, the Emperor Napoleon III. It was under Napoleon III that Baron Haussmann rebuilt Paris, creating those magnificent boulevards with covered glass canopies and arcades. Very like Lord Street. A professor of architecture, according to a leaflet I got in the tourist centre, has argued that Napoleon must indeed have been influenced by Southport. Could Paris's grand design really have been modelled on Lord Street? What on earth was Louis Napoleon doing in Southport in the first place? However, it was time for my real appointment, and to try to understand an even bigger and more intriguing mystery. How come this rather remote seaside town has got the world's one and only lawnmower museum? The outside of the museum gives an immediate clue. It turns out to be a shopfront, housing Stanley's Discount Garden Machinery Warehouse. I went in and was confronted by rows and rows of gleaming new lawnmowers of all shapes and sizes. An elderly gent was at the counter, arguing that he had bought his lawnmower here 2 years ago, so surely it was still under guarantee. The Lawnmower Museum is upstairs. I didn't want to go straight in, as by now my rule was always to talk to the creator first, if at all possible, or, if not him or her, then to the present curator. Having done that, I aim to talk them into going round with me, so I can ask them endless dopey questions. Brian Radham was on the premises, dealing with a customer, but I was told to go right up to the museum and he would see me soon. Might as well, I thought, have a quick look on my own, see it as others see it, even if I have to pay. Naturally, if I have rung ahead and arranged a meeting, I don't usually have to pay. They take me in. I'm not daft, just careful. Entrance was only £2, and even I was prepared to splash out, a bargain in this day and age for any sort of museum. I pushed past a little turnstile at the bottom of the stairs and went up. The moment I entered the landing, I was confronted by 5 rooms, crammed with all sorts of vintage lawnmowers and related relics. And immediately, from somewhere unseen, music started playing. Then a TV screen sprang into life, and a commentator with a broad Lancashire accent started giving me an explanation of all the delights before me. I was alone in the museum, having passed through the unattended turnstile and up the stairs. So I reckoned I must have activated some infrared starting mechanism on the stairs, which sparked off this delightful audio-visual explanation. Just for me. The music was a sort of mock country and western with a jaunty singer telling me about the man who invented the first lawnmower. Rather informative, if not exactly musically distinguished. The commentary itself was packed with fascinating facts, which I tried to take down in my notebook, but it was all a bit quick and overwhelming. The video display turned out to be mainly slides of old and modern lawnmowers, but jolly interesting all the same. I watched it to the end. Then Brian Radham himself appeared, small, slender, big specs, small pointy beard, while I was still getting my bearings. I asked him to turn off the audio-visual stuff, if he wouldn't mind, as I'd like to talk to him first before touring the museum properly. I sat on the stairs, while he stood beside me, and asked him questions for about 30 minutes, till suddenly the music and audio-visual stuff burst into life again, making me jump. An elderly foursome, all smiles and giggles, were coming up the stairs, having paid their £2. We then went downstairs to his little overcrowded office, where his wife Sue was sorting through what looked like bills, invoices and contracts. Brian is the son of Stanley Radham, who opened the shop in 1945 as Southport's first DIY outlet, specialising in selling and repairing garden implements. It started in one shop, then when business expanded, he bought the adjoining shops till he had the whole corner. Brian was born in 1951, left school at 16, and went to be an apprentice with ATCO. He also did an apprenticeship as a locksmith, becoming a fellow of the Master Locksmiths Association. ATCO, one of the best-known names in lawnmowers, stands for Atlas Chain Company, and began in 1865 in Birmingham, making chains for ships before moving into lawnmowers. In the late 60s, when Brian joined them at their repair centre near Preston, it was just one of 8 ATCO depots across the country. All they did, all year round, was service and repair lawnmowers. At our depot, there was a staff of over 50, and we repaired 425 ATCO lawnmowers every week. Originally, they had mechanics who drove a motorbike and sidecar, and when they went out on a job, if they couldn't repair it there and then, they would bring back the lawnmower in the sidecar. Oh, those were the days. I felt proud to work there. British people have always taken great pride in their lawns. We've always had the best in the world, oh yes. You don't get our sort of lawns in California, and in France and Italy they don't care the way we do. I'm talking about ordinary people. If you're a rich Californian, then you can throw a tanker of water over your lawn. If you're really rich, you can paint it green. But ordinary folks abroad are not obsessed by lawns like the British. We always have been. It's part of our culture. We have the right kind of grass and the right kind of climate and the right kind of mentality. The old adverts for the early lawnmowers used to say, "Gentlemen will find it an amusing and healthy experience." That's still true. I would say that out of every 100 people in Britain today who have a lawn, about half of them find it a drag, a real chore to mow it. But the other half, well, they love it. They take pride in making it look as good as possible, with perfect lines and stripes. It is still a pleasurable thing to mow a lawn, and very healthy. Oh, it were great days at ATCO, wonderful to work there. I felt proud it was a British company, and that all our competitors were British companies with generations of service to British lawns behind us. The quality of our lawnmowers was the best in the world, and we had the best mechanics. Alas, poor old Brian didn't at that time realise he was about to witness the end of the traditional British lawnmower industry. By the 1980s it had practically crumbled away. I remember the day I discovered that the new supermarkets were selling lawnmowers for £6, while we were charging £10 to repair an old one. That signalled the end. These mass-produced, cheaply made plastic lawnmowers were soon everywhere. Even though most fell to pieces after 1 year, people didn't care. They just bought another, they were so cheap. In the old days, if you bought a good lawnmower, you would never buy another one. If serviced once a year and cared for properly, they would last you a lifetime. Many people really did only ever have one lawnmower. Once the disposable age had come in, that was it. It's like cameras and mobile phones and computers. It's normal now to get a new one every year as new models come in or the old ones pack up and can't be repaired. People don't do repairing anymore. They just want to sell you a new model. And all the new models are mass-produced cheaply abroad. At least they are with lawnmowers. ATCO is still going, but is German-owned, so is Qualcast. Ransom's is American-owned, and so is Shank's. All these great British names all gone from our shores. I find it very sad. Just before ATCO closed, he returned to Southport to work with his dad in the shop. He got married to Sue, and together they eventually took over the running of the shop when Stanley retired. He was still alive, by the way, aged 86, coming into the shop a few times each week, but I never saw him. I found a lot of old lawnmowers in the back, perhaps kept originally in case their parts might come in handy, but mostly they had been scrapped, waiting to be chucked out. Looking through them, I found some famous names like Royal Enfield, Vincent, Hawker Siddeley and Rolls-Royce, firms most people don't realise ever produced lawnmowers. I got some of them cleaned up and in working order and put a few of them in the shop window, just for interest. I found other, even older ones lying around, and I thought, we can't scrap this or that, we must keep them, do them up and preserve them. Then people started bringing in their old ones and giving them to us, perhaps one they'd inherited or had for up to 60 years, after they noticed what we had in our window. And that's really how it all began.
No one else was keeping old lawnmowers. No one else was bothered about old machines. We felt we had to, it was our duty. So that's when we thought of the idea of having a proper museum. They opened in 1986, and over the years, the British Lawnmower Museum, as it proudly calls itself, has had quite a lot of national publicity, considering where it is and what it contains. But I suppose its novelty value does attract interest, makes people smile, and perhaps, though I would not dare say it in front of Brian, who is a true believer, allied with amusement there is often a tone of mockery. It does seem very British, very eccentric, very daft. Brian himself has appeared on Blue Peter with some of his lawnmowers, though this was about 15 years ago. Blue Peter itself has now gone flash and modern and superficial. He took along the very latest Robos lawnmower, as well as some vintage ones, and did a demonstration. It worked all right, but Blue Peter's sheepdog was on the programme and it got very confused, thinking the robot lawnmower was a sheep and trying to chase it. He has also appeared on a TV programme with Robbie Coltrane on his tour of Britain, and on other shows, though most of them seem to have been some years ago. The sort of TV magazine programmes that all regions used to have, featuring odd quirks of British life, seem to have dried up in recent years. For all its fame, the museum still has an amateur, enthusiast, homemade, do-it-yourself provincial feel to it, which is how it should be, as that is how lawnmowers first began. The first one was patented in 1830 by Edwin Beard Budding of Stroud in Gloucestershire. He had noticed in a local cloth mill how some cylinder blades fixed on a bench were being used to trim the nap on finished cloth, to smooth out all the rough and bobbly bits on material such as guardsmen's uniforms. He thought a similar principle could be applied to cutting lawns, and invented a machine carrying cylinder blades, mounted on wheels, and which were rotated by the motion of the wheels. He is reputed to have made his first trial runs at night, fearful that the locals would think he was mad. It worked, and he went into partnership with a friend, and they patented the first lawnmower. Budding is also credited with inventing the first adjustable spanner. Lawns had existed before, but only around stately homes, for until that moment only aristocrats and the wealthy could afford to have them mown. This was done by hand using scythes, usually by a team of 8 men with 8 women and boys following behind picking up the grass. They worked non-stop in the grass-growing season. Each grown man had his scythe handmade to match his height and strength. It's all in the angle and the sharpness of the blade, not just brute muscle power, as anyone who has tried to scythe thistles will have found out. You often see 18th century illustrations of teams of scythers in fields as well as on lawns, looking knackered. Early cricket pitches were also mown by hand, though on the edges, in the rough, sheep were allowed to graze to keep the grass down. Naturally, they also deposited sheep shit, so when a fielder ran into the rough ground, he would often slip on it, hence the term in the slips. I'm not sure if this is true, but it should be. Budding built only 600 lawnmowers, for one man, and also a bigger model for 2 men, one to push and one to pull. But the lawnmower he invented basically stayed the same from the late 1830s to the present day. Other forms of mowing lawns have come along in the meantime, but the old hand-pushed rotating cylinder system always remained. In this environmentally friendly age, I am sure they will soon come back into popularity again, as they are so morally and ethically correct. No nasty petrol or electricity or carbon footprint. What can be more desirable than that? One of the early lawnmower manufacturers using Budding's patents was Ransoms of Ipswich, who were making lawnmowers from 1832. Budding's patents ran out in the 1850s and lots more makers piled in, bringing their own variations. But until the end of the 19th century, most lawnmowers had to be pushed or pulled by hand or using horses. The big houses had big lawnmowers, pulled by teams of men and horses. One of the early Scottish lawnmower manufacturers was Shanks of Arbroath, who called one of their best-known models Shanks's Pony.
This was because it was pulled by a pony, but it also needed a man to walk behind to guide the machine and the pony. And yes, the walker also became known as Shanks's pony, hence the well-known phrase.
"Not long after I started the museum," says Brian, "I got a call from an old lady in the Lake District. She was 96 and had been brought up in a stately home, but had now gone into a care home and was clearing out her possessions. She had vivid memories of their family's coachman using the same horses to pull the lawnmower. In some old stables, she still had an 1880 lawnmower made by Greens of Leeds, the sort that was pulled by a pony. She asked if I would like it. She also gave me something I had never seen before. Special leather boots that were put on the horses before they started mowing the best lawns. This was to protect the lawns, stop them leaving marks. She also told me that her coachman had devised a system for stopping the horses shitting while on the best lawns. He would drive them to the side onto the rougher stuff and blow his whistle and they would perform. They would then return to the main lawn. Obviously he must have known their habits, or perhaps he really had trained them. Hand or horse-drawn mowers had no rivals until towards the end of the century, when at long last someone invented a steam-driven lawnmower. I was surprised it had taken so long when you think that George Stephenson had perfected a steam-driven railway engine as early as 1825. However, when they did eventually hit the market, they were almost immediately replaced by another invention, the internal combustion engine. A similar thing happened with canals as a mode of transport. They were really getting into their stride when railways were invented.
Very, very few steam-driven lawnmowers were ever made. Leyland made their first in 1892, but only about 100, that was all. I would dearly love one. The Leyland Transport Museum haven't got one. All they have is a replica.
Carl Benz, one of the two Germans who invented the petrol-driven engine around the year 1886, originally worked on lawnmowers, among various other machines. The other inventor was Gottlieb Daimler, who lived just 60 miles away from Benz in the Neckar Valley, yet amazingly they never met. By the 1900s, petrol-driven lawnmowers, as well as motorcars, had arrived, but their mass use came in the 1920s when prices came down and cheaper lawnmowers made by firms like Atco flooded the market. The suburban gardener became as proud of his manicured lawn, complete with stripes and perfect edges, as the old aristocrats had ever been. Social equality, you see, had been made possible by the use of lawnmowers. Flymo introduced the hovering lawnmower in the 1960s with a single blade that rotates. But of course, it does not create stripes, nor does it have a roller, so boo to that, say all true lawnmower purists. They were, however, produced in massive numbers, and very cheaply, and were light to use, being made mainly of plastic. They were bought by people who just wanted the job done as quickly and easily as possible, i.e. women. The early ones came in blue, but Flymo then did a survey of 2,000 of their female customers, asking them which colour they would prefer. The answer was orange, still Flymo's signature colour today. Ride-on mowers, big enough to be climbed on and driven like a car, date from 1904 and were first developed by Ransoms. They are very popular with wealthier or more macho gardeners, with big or rough gardens who like a bit of showing off. After all these decades, there are still only three basic lawnmower cutting systems. Cylinder blades, turning against a fixed blade, and the rotating spinning blade are the two most common. The third one is the reciprocating knife, like those scissors barbers often use, with the two blades interlocking. You don't come across this much in domestic use, but they can often be seen on rough, overgrown areas. All these systems, and all possible forms of power, are faithfully and lovingly preserved by Brian in his museum. On show in his five rooms, he has at any one time around 200 models on display, all in spanking, gleaming condition, plus another 600 behind the scenes. I got him to take me round, which anyone can do as he loves doing guided tours so long as the shop is not too busy, and for this he charges £6, as opposed to £2 for the automated audio tour. The biggest lawnmower on show is a 1926 Dennis, which at the time cost about £75, the same as a small house. The smallest that works is a 6-inch mower from the 1930s, used for graveyards. Strimmers, by the way, go back many decades, but they were not called strimmers until recent times. The longest-serving mower ever was a machine made by Greens in the 1860s and called the Silens Messor, meaning silent cutter. They were very fond of having Latin names at one time, just to make them sound classy. Another smaller one was called Multum in Parvo, much in a small size. The Silens model was sold for over 70 years, until the 1930s, and is in the Guinness Book of Records as the domestic machine that remained unchanged for the longest period of time. One of the biggest lawn mowers on show is one presented by ATCO to Prince Charles and Lady Diana on their wedding in 1981. It's a large, ride-on machine, and was used at Highgrove until fairly recently, then became redundant and ended up with Brian. He is clearly fond of celeb mowers, machines once owned by the famous, presumably believing that in this day and age a celebrity name will bring in punters who would otherwise not be interested in a lawnmower museum. I couldn't quite see the point. As an old lawnmower owned by, say, Hilda Ogden, or at least the actress Jean Alexander, is exactly the same model owned by millions of others, but Brian enjoys collecting them. Amongst his celeb items, all neatly and reverently marked, are mowers once used by Lily Savage, Alan Titchmarsh, Vanessa Feltz, and Ainsley Harriet. Brian is particularly pleased to have a mower donated by Brian May of Queen, complete with a handwritten letter. As a teenager, Brian played in a rock band as a semi-professional, before realizing that mowers were the way to national fame, if not fortune. Nicholas Parsons promised to donate his lawn mower, but it got stolen, and he had to send a pair of secateurs instead. I was amused to see in one cabinet a fairly boring Woolworths-style trowel with a wooden handle, which had formerly belonged to the poet Roger McGough. I wonder if he handed it over as a joke. I also learned that Charles Darwin used a Samuelson donkey mower on his lawns in 1857, though they don't have the exact one. In various cabinets and display cases are toy lawn mowers, lawn mower models, books, advertisements, posters, and lawn mower memorabilia, but all a bit thin when you think how long lawn mowers have been going. Perhaps they had never been considered exciting objects compared with, say, steam trains, till Brian came along. There is not even a proper history of lawn mowers, which seems a great shame, and only a few children's stories featuring lawn mowers. Electric mowers are not as modern as I had imagined. On show is a Ransom's electric model from 1926 that you plugged into the mains in your house, at a time when most ordinary houses did not yet have electricity. The robot lawn mower, solar-powered, the one Brian demonstrated on Blue Peter, looks very weird and space-agey amongst all the solid wrought-iron Victorian contraptions. It was made in Sweden and cost the company £1 million to develop. Each costs £2,000, and it can cut any lawn of any shape without supervision, avoids obstacles, and plugs itself in when it needs recharging. Truly a wonder. But they didn't do very well in Britain, not just because we are too mean to spend that amount of money, but, according to Brian, because we still like our mowers with old-fashioned cylinders so we can make pretty patterns. And also, we like the exercise. One of the oddities is what looks like a miniature sports car, which ATCO made in 1939, converting a lawnmower into a motor car to be used for training motorists. Not many of these were ever made as the war came along, and so today they are greatly prized by lawnmowerists, if there is such a word, who will pay up to £7,000 to have one. There are, of course, many lawnmower collectors, as I had expected, though without ever having come across one. Out there somewhere, Brian estimates that there are about 200 keen collectors, most of them members of the old lawnmower club. There's also the Atco Car Owners Club, of which he is a member. Brian has rarely ever had to buy an old machine, as almost all of them have been given to him or assembled from old parts. He estimates that the total cost of his museum has been about £10, which covers both the cost of converting the old upstairs rooms and all the lawnmowers on show. He was once about to splash out when he saw a particular lawnmower on sale at Sotheby's. He reckoned it was worth only £40, but decided at the last minute to leave a telephone bid of £200, as he very much wanted the parts for mending similar machines. When I told Sue what I had done, she was furious, said I was being really silly. But I didn't get it. It was sold for £1,200. That's about the most Brian has ever heard of being paid for a traditional old lawnmower, though specialist or one-off rarities can command much larger prices, such as a silver Qualcast mower that was produced in a limited edition of only 10. The only time he has spent real money was on documents, not machines. Buying a collection of 500 original lawnmower patents from the early 19th century, some from as early as 1799, on parchment, and including many that had belonged to Mr. Budding. They came complete with drawings and full details and are, of course, a vital part of engineering history. It took me a while to get out of him how much he had actually paid. He eventually admitted in a hushed voice that they had cost him £5,000. I said that was nothing compared with what people will pay for old motor cars, or even an old wireless. Going round, I was very surprised to learn about the existence of racing mowers. I sat in one, wearing a crash helmet, just in case it burst into life. Brian used to be a champion, but has recently retired, having reached his 50s. There is a British Lawnmower Racing Association, which holds races once or twice a month, all over the country. It's the cheapest form of motorsport you can find. Most of the races are run for charity, but it is taken seriously. People do want to win. One of the regular races is over 350 miles, and is run like the Le Mans race, and can take 12 hours. The rules insist that each lawnmower must have been able to cut grass, though in actual races the blades are taken off for safety reasons. You can't make the engine bigger than it actually was, and it must still look like a lawnmower, however much you modify it. Many of the bigger, more expensive lawnmowers have 320cc engines, which is quite enough power, really. They're designed to do only 6 mph while cutting grass, but they can easily be made to do 30 mph. Over 30 mph, well, it can be pretty hairy. They develop a mind of their own and do what they like. I've done 65 mph myself, but the world record is about 90 mph. We're still working here in the workshop on a lawnmower that will beat that and reach 100 mph, but I haven't had the time to work on it recently. When the sport was first established in 1983, it received quite a bit of attention, and several well-known people took part, such as Stirling Moss and Oliver Reed, the actor. Oliver Reed ran over someone who was in the toilet tent at the time, so he wasn't exactly in complete control. It was said he was half-cut. Probably true, as he was a notorious drinker, but also a well-known joke amongst lawnmowerists, along with the mower the merrier, a cut above the rest, don't let the grass grow under your feet, many of which appear in the audio commentary about the museum, which is spoken by Brian's brother-in-law. The song, a country and western ditty about Mr. Budding, which can be heard on a DVD sold in the museum, is sung and written by Doug Miles, a direct descendant of Edwin Budding. I got this call one day from someone I didn't know, offering me some music he had written about lawnmowers. He sent it to me and I thought it was pretty good. He said I could use it if I wanted to in the museum. That was when he told me he was related to Budding. Another example of Brian getting things free for his museum, because people like his enthusiasm and expertise so much they want to help him. So, does his museum make any money? Each year, he attracts about 6,000 visitors, which at £2 a time, in theory, might pay one man's wages. He doesn't directly employ anyone in the museum, but he himself is always on hand. We still run on a shoestring, but no, we're not struggling. Overall, we make a profit. Naturally, I would like to win the lottery and do the museum out properly, make it professional, but that's not going to happen. I did get all the forms for a Heritage Lottery Fund grant. I spoke to some woman and she said we ticked all the boxes, part of engineering history, teaching young people, as we get a lot of school parties and engineering students in, and other things. But then when I saw all the forms, I couldn't cope. None of us had the time to work on them. So we've got no grants of any kind, from the government or the local council or charities. We are totally on our own. The reason he makes money is that, thanks to the museum and its fame around the world with lawnmower enthusiasts, he gets a lot of vintage mowers sent in for repair or requiring parts. Over the decades, he has collected hundreds of old lawnmower manuals from long-gone manufacturers, which are now unavailable anywhere else. He sells copies of these for a flat fee of £10, and that's a very good earner. On the retail side, downstairs where they sell and repair new lawnmowers, there is a staff of three, all trained experts. Repairing lawnmowers is, of course, a dying art, and Brian gets very depressed when he has school leavers approach him for work experience or to learn about lawnmowers. Do you realise they don't do metalwork or even woodwork in our schools anymore? Shocking. I get kids coming here, not thick kids, who can't use a screwdriver except for stabbing each other. One of them the other day was handed a nut and bolt and told to put it on a lawnmower, and he had never seen a nut and bolt before and had no idea what it was. This country invented the lawnmower, produced the best ones ever, and we had the best engineers of all kinds. Now we don't know anything and we don't care anymore. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. Many museum people have said similar things to me on my travels, such as the wireless man and the fan lady. They fear their knowledge and enthusiasm will die with them. And so probably will the items they have collected, or else they will get shoved in store in some dusty municipal museum. I believe, however, that the attitude of mind that breeds obsessive collectors and preservationists will always be there, as it is in the human spirit. It's just that the Bryans of the future will fall in love with different things, such as old mobile phones, computers, digital cameras, stuff that is being dumped, but that they realise has a fascinating history. It's probably already happening, only their museums have not yet opened. There were lots of lawnmowers I would gladly have taken away, as he has restored and painted and polished them so nicely. Nothing too big, of course, just something to put on a shelf along with, say, an old Blow football game or vintage Subutio. It would be a neat cross-reference. Most of all, I will definitely take away his clever entrance scheme, whereby you let yourself in on your own, and instantly it's all singing, all dancing. Dead smart. So, what about his own future? He and his wife Sue have no children, so no obvious person to inherit his little empire, but he hopes that whoever takes over the shop side will always keep the museum going. I want it always to be kept together as a museum, even if that does mean it being shipped to the USA after some rich American has bought it. Not that I want that to happen, but it would keep it all together and give it purpose-built premises. I have a friend who runs his own microbrewery, which is doing very well, but he now wants to expand. We have this daft fantasy that we discuss all the time, half as a joke, about buying an old barn together out in the country and converting it. One half would be the brewery and the other half the lawnmower museum. Imagine looking at all the old lawnmowers, then sitting down and having a pint. Wouldn't that be a really wonderful and unusual attraction? Well, it would certainly put Southport on the map, and perhaps help the museum keep going forever. As it should. Lawnmowers are not funny. Not really. If asked, in future I will still smile, but add quickly and seriously that their history is fascinating. Lawnmowers are not sexy or exciting, nor do they come with their own natural fans like, say, the Beatles or football.
So it's unlikely that anyone will ever again collect enough to open a museum, unlike old motor cars. There are museums of vintage motor vehicles all over Britain and the world. New ones are always opening, and rare vehicles fetch millions of pounds. Old cars can be very attractive and even beautiful, while poor old lawnmowers can be a bit plain and lumpen. But lawnmowers are part of our social engineering and economic history, part of what we think has made Britain British. Our Sunday afternoons, our rolling lawns, our green and pleasant land. Now, when I watch Premiership football on TV, I often find myself clapping in delight when I spot a well-mown, well-cared-for pitch with exact lines, or, even harder, perfect concentric circles radiating from the centre spot. Pretty, but pointless, of course, as players and refs don't need such magical, almost mystical markings on a football pitch. I find myself wondering what sort of mower, scissor blades, perhaps, has been used, and what sort of roller, and I think, ah, some of our traditions have not been completely lost. British Lawnmower Museum, 106 to 114 Shakespeare Street, Southport, Lancashire, PR8, 5AJ. www.lawnmowerworld.co.uk. Chapter 7. The National Football Museum, Preston. Football is my joint first collecting passion, along with the Beatles. Visiting the Casbah was amusing, a trip down memory lane, but what is mainly being museumed there is the building itself, the preservation of a stage in Beatles history, of memories and atmosphere rather than an actual collection, as they don't have many Beatles-related items. But visiting the National Football Museum at Preston, oh my God, to me it was overwhelming, stupendous, unbelievable. Every football fan of any age and sex from any country in the world should visit the National Football Museum, for there is nothing like it anywhere. At the same time, I came away depressed, fed up, thinking, what is the point? My stuff is so piddling and petty, why do I bother? They've got so much in such wonderful condition, thousands and thousands of items, most of which I never even knew existed. Bugger it, I might as well go back to stamps. As with stamps, I became a born-again football collector. I'd cut out my football heroes as a boy, stuck them in homemade albums, then forgot about them. My return was sparked off by the World Cup final of 1966, keeping my ticket as well as the programme. But I didn't actively go out looking for footer stuff until I gave up stamps. When I sold all the stamps, I deliberately put the proceeds, such as they were, into the Beatles and football. With programmes, I concentrate on Spurs, and have got them back to 1910. And with England-Scotland games, I go back to 1927. But now the prices are so great, I probably won't go any earlier, though I might be tempted if something reasonable comes along. I have very low standards when it comes to condition, and am always willing to buy tatty examples as long as I can read them. I also collect football books, and now have most of the classic examples from 1890 to 1910, and football magazines and football postcards. I tend, in the main, to go for memorabilia that I can read and study, that has content. I've always avoided shirts, suspecting they might be frauds, especially the autographed ones, and anyway they are hell to keep or display, whereas books can be on shelves and postcards in albums. I had half imagined I was one of the few football memorabilia collectors till I heard about the football collection assembled by Harry Langton. He was born in Yorkshire in 1929 and became a sports journalist and football collector and dealer. He started collecting football items in the early 1950s when his wife gave him an old football print as a present. He went on to acquire thousands of football items. I never met him, but was in contact once about going to see his stuff. I never did. Can't remember why. In the early 1990s, he had done a deal with FIFA, the world governing body of football based in Switzerland, and sold the main part of his collection. In 1996, they produced a beautiful, lavishly illustrated book in several languages called The FIFA Museum Collection, based on Harry's material. It